YPG's Desert Rats tested weapons of war so they'd work when soldiers' lives depended on them. Thousands of veterans walk the earth today thanks to their work. After decades of service, all that's left is testament. Desert Rat Testament is a monthly anthology that collects the stories and recollections of retired Yuma Proving Ground employees of decades-long service.
Hello, I'm Mark Schauer. With a combined 46 years of service in uniform and as a Department of the Army civilian, Ron Rodriguez grew up the Army brat son of a World War II, Korea, and Vietnam veteran. Enlisting 4 years after his dad retired, Rodriguez spent his Army career as a military policeman and came to Yuma Proving Ground to oversee the post's law enforcement and emergency management functions in 2004. Unlike a lot of people here, you had heard of Yuma Proving Ground well before you ever worked here.
Yes, that's correct. Back in probably the 60s, I was here at some point, no older than 10 years old. My dad had a buddy who he had served with who had retired, and I don't know if he was working at Yuma Proving Ground, but he definitely lived in Yuma, so we were here at that point. And then after Desert Storm 91 to 93, I was stationed in Los Angeles in what was known as a readiness group, which were active duty soldiers advising reserve component units. And one of my units, the 855th MP Company out of the Arizona National Guard, was here, and part of it's still here in Yuma.
You retired from active duty in 2000, worked for a private security firm, and your wife didn't like that so much.
Yeah, so I went to work for a nationally known security firm in Atlanta. I was the Atlanta area manager, and I would get calls from guards at 2 o'clock in the morning telling me their relief hadn't shown up, and then I'd get up and have to find somebody or actually take it on myself at times to go out there and relieve them. And my wife complained that I was getting phone calls I hadn't even gotten as a first sergeant when I was in the Army. So she
kind of convinced me I needed to find a better job at that point.
And lo and behold, there was an opening at Yuma Proving Ground.
Well, eventually. First, I went back to work. I retired out of Army Central Command. I went back there to work there as an anti-terrorism analyst, a contractor. And that job got undersold to a competing company, and so then we became concerned about the job security. So then eventually I applied for jobs in Atlanta, primarily with Federal Protective Services. I interviewed for a job in Northcom. Interestingly enough, I think it was Southwestern region at the time. And then I interviewed for the physical security chief out here, and that's the one I got hired for in 2004.
Now, not long after that, we set up a dedicated DPTMS capability. He was the first leader of it.
Yeah, so we stood up IMA, I believe, in November of 2003. I got here in January of 2004. And it was actually May of 2006. I actually stood up both the Director of Emergency Services and the Director of Plans, Training, Mobilization, Security from what was previously known as the Director of Law Enforcement Security. About a year and a half, not quite a year and a half after I got here.
And DPTMS's prime play was in anti-terrorism and emergency management.
Those were the two primary functions initially. We were joined by the museum very soon afterwards. Later, we got a DCIPS security function added on. Emergency management split out from operations and became a separate entity. And we actually hired a suburban officer, but eventually that became the emergency manager position. As you know, we had two people in the museum for a time. And at our height, we were probably 9 people, if I remember correctly. And we almost took over the airfield. I spent about 4 years along with Iris Espinoza working on the transition of the airfield from ATEC to MCOM. But I learned more about airfields in that time than I'd ever thought I would need to know.
I'm thinking about some of the real-world, typically weather emergencies that happened along the way, like the time in 2010 when 400-some people were stranded on KFR because of the 24-hour rainfall, and you had to orchestrate getting those folks evacuated.
Yeah, the irony is I called somebody that morning, probably about 4:30, 5:30, sometime around there, and I had already gotten from at what that time was the police desk notification that Aberdeen Wash was running pretty fast and pretty high, and I recommended that we not let anybody go into COFA. And the decision to listen to that was made at about 8:30 that morning, by which time it was too late. So, yeah, January 20th, 2010, as a matter of fact. And so we spent, as you know, most of the day handling that. DPW came up with a out-of-the-box but probably very risky solution, which was to build a gravel road across the wash. And, of course, it got washed out numerous times, but we did manage to evacuate COFA and send people home that day. So, you know, it turned out successful, but it definitely had the ability to go the wrong way.
Some years later, there was an incident on Highway 95, at least some kind of domestic violence thing that spilled over into the highway. There was gunfire, and we locked down the post for a few hours.
Yeah, I'm not even sure it was domestic violence. We thought it might have been some type of personal issue gone wrong, and it happened during COVID, so we only had two people from DPTMS in the building at the time, and so we stood up the EOC with other people that happened to be on the installation that might not have normally been on it, because a lot of us were teleworking on and off during that time period. And our police ended up responding because of life, health, and safety, and shots being fired out there while we had people moving around that were working. So, yeah, that was a pretty interesting day.
I think about anti-terrorism. The program here to promote anti-terrorism awareness was very robust, up to and including the creation of an anti-terrorism flag. Why was that so important to promote awareness here?
So I think the flag, and one of our former anti-terrorism officers, Vince Avanzini, kind of came up with that concept. I think the flag brought attention to Anti-Terrorism Awareness Month and anti-terrorism in general that otherwise was kind of missing. And, of course, as you know, we went out for a few years and displayed that flag, had that flag jump with the Free Fall School out on Phillips Drop Zone, and it hit the outpost, and I think we even had some TV coverage of it, if I remember correctly. And so I think it created an awareness that we had not really been successful at getting before. And part of the result of that was, and I don't remember which year, I want to say 17, I think we got the Small Installation Anti-Terrorism Award for the Department of the Army. So, you know, it did become very robust and very successful.
I know it was very unlikely that the museum would have fallen into your purview, but it did and was under it for many years and very, very successful while we were allowed to have it stood up.
So my first day here, January 12th of 2004, when the DLES was actually located where the current exchange is, I had done all the in-processing I could get done that day, so I went over to Building S2 because I was told the museum was in there, and I walked through there, and the building was a great collection of photographs, and there were photographs that were specific to YPG and to the California-Arizona maneuver area, but there was not, it was not a specifically YPG-themed museum or display at the time. In fact, it was more of a display than a museum at that point. There were pictures from the Korean War. There were pictures that just had nothing to do with YPG. They're just general army pictures. Bill Heidner took the museum over in late 2004, and then in 2006, he got assigned initially to the DLES because we were going to become the DPTMS. And the first time I walked in the museum, it wasn't what you and I know it ended up as, but what a change. I mean, he already had galleries set up for California, Arizona maneuver area. He had the bridging displays set up, a number of other displays. And I learned a lot with Bill in there. I mean, that was, you know, I actually went, as you know, I'm a martial arts nut. I went to Burbank and went to the martial arts museum, and it was the same type of graphics, the same way of displaying that Bill used were being used in the martial arts museum. So Bill taught me a lot that made me appreciate museums more.
You're particularly enthusiastic about kendo as a martial art. And were you surprised to find a thriving kendo community in Yuma, Arizona?
So, and I think you know this, which is why you asked the question. Bill Heidner and I were talking. Bill and I would have historical conversations. A lot of them had to do with different wars, World War II being among them. And of course, at that point, Steve Greeley, I think, was either in there or had just left. And Steve was very big on historical displays. So Bill and I were talking about Japan. And I told Bill about this movie I'd seen back in the 70s and this one scene from it. And it's funny because I watched that scene, ironically, this morning because it popped up on my Facebook feed. It intrigued me. And from that point on, I wanted to try kendo out. And talking to Bill that day, I told him that. I said, oh, there's this movie that I saw in 1974, and there was this one scene, and I've always wanted to take kendo because of that. He goes, well, why don't you go to the museum and or go to the college and take it? I'm like, what college? Arizona Western College. I said, there's no kendo at Arizona Western College. He goes, yeah, there is. They do it in the gym every Saturday. And so I went and I looked into it, and sure enough, there was a kendo class. And in 2016, I signed up for it, and with a few breaks, just got off one because of some personal injuries and stuff. But with a few breaks, COVID being the most notable, I've been doing kendo most Saturdays since 2016.
Is it difficult for you to walk away from Yuma Proving Ground?
In some ways it is. I'm not going to name names because I don't want to embarrass somebody that won't know I'm talking about them. But I got an email this morning saying, hey, I understand you're getting ready to retire, and it's been a pleasure working with you, and then goodbye, friend. And so people like that I'm going to miss. You know, there's people that make your job easier. And one of the things I've really gotten into lately is getting around ego and looking for positivity. And that's kind of where I'm headed now, is I'm looking to, you know, control the amount of negativity I have in my life. And there's a lot of philosophy on that, on you'll react to the type of environment you allow yourself to be put in. So there's things I won't miss, and there's definitely things and people I will miss.
Are you going to keep up with Yuma Proving Ground in retirement?
Sure. I've got Facebook. The public affairs office puts things out, and it's one of my groups that I follow.
Hey, Ron, it's really good talking to you today.
Mark, thank you. Appreciate your support over the years.
For as long as the United States has a military, Yuma Proving Ground will be vital to the national defense. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time on The Testament.